For those of you that don't know, I was on a sabbatical for 4.5 months, which is a great long period of time. I was last here in my capacity as the rector of the church on April the 29th, which you may remember was shortly after a little day in the calendar we call Easter. And so I don't actually remember very much of that entire week. There was a lot going on, and it was all fabulous, and I don't even know if I had the opportunity then to express my thanks to the community for everyone who pitched in to make the Easter festival so beautiful. So now, thank you for making the Easter festival so beautiful. I left these United States of America on May the 5th, which means I had about a week at my little house to get ready to go, which included packing everything I had, included packing up my icon painting supplies, and shipping those to England, which was an adventure. I had a lot of spectacular things happen, and some of you don't know this, that my sabbatical was funded by a little corporation called the Lilly Endowment, which gave a grant of almost $50,000 for my sabbatical leave. About $12,000 of that stayed here to supplement the budget and supplement Carrie's salary in my absence. And some of that is going to go to scholarships for the parish retreat, which is coming right up. And if you are one of the people that said, oh yeah, I'm going to sign up for that, today is the day to do it, or else I can't guarantee what might happen. And if Carrie is still in the room, she will pull her app out and sign you up. If I'm in the room and not talking, I will sign you up. So I went to England, and I actually arrived a week after I left because I decided it would be a great way to spend a corporation's money to do a transatlantic crossing on the Queen Mary 2, which was great. And people are like, did you see all the shows and all this stuff? I was like, no, mostly I stayed in my cabin and walked on the deck and sat at my single table in the restaurant. The first night I went into the restaurant, and the captain was like, the desk captain was like, we have you at a table of 8. And I said, no, 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 no. You have not met me before. I would very much like to dine by myself all week, which I did, which was lovely. So I had a lot of time on this crossing to do very little. I don't know if you've ever gone in the North Atlantic in the first week of May, but it can be a little stormy, as it was. So I didn't spend a great deal of time, you know, laying out in the sun, because there was none. But I finally arrived in Southampton on the 12th of May and got myself to Oxford, where I saw our beloved former St. Gregory's intern and assistant priest, Andy Schammel, who says the following, tell everyone hello. Andy, as you may know, is engaged to be married to a woman named Sorrel, who is also training in one of the Oxford Seminary programs. She is at, Rick, remind me of the place that she's at, Cuddleston. Cudston. I always mispronounce it. Cudston. It is a beautiful place. Andy's doing great. He's working on his PhD. He invited me to go to his seminar on modern theology, which I did, so I felt very English. Sitting with the English people in the dean's thing, room, they call it something, listening to a woman talk about, her book was about women theologians in the 20th century who wrote fiction. It was a really interesting book. And I did other things while I was at Oxford. And then, I'm trying to roll this out, I got on the train and made it to West Yorkshire. Now, what do you know about West Yorkshire? Okay, good. There's a lot of country up there. And there are some nice towns, including a town called, wait for it, Murfield. Murfield. M-I-R-F-I-E-L-D. Which is a really interesting place. Murfield is a not a big town. The biggest city nearby is Leeds. But it is a place of great significance in the history of St. Gregory's, because in Murfield there is a place called the Community of the Resurrection, which is an Anglican monastic community, which was founded in the late 19th century by a group of men. It was a men's monastic community who were at Oxford. And they originally founded it around Oxford. And then they decided, this is too cushy. We want to go somewhere else. And so they did their research and they found the one town in England of which at the time it was written, you cannot pick a flower without pulling your hand away black from the soot. So it was a mill town. It was a very poor mill town. But in this very poor mill town, there was a manor house, and they bought the manor house, which is where they started this community. Now, the Community of the Resurrection is interesting in many ways. It's interesting because its founders are actually commemorated on the calendar of the Episcopal Church. And it's interesting because as it was founded, it was a period of Anglican history where there's a great deal of interest in socialism and a great deal of interest in what was called Christian anarchy and a great deal of interest in getting away from the corruption of the city, which has always been a motivation for monasticism, right? Going way back to the Desert Fathers and Mothers. You like had to escape from Alexandria, the flesh pots of Alexandria, to go live out in the country, in the desert. So these men went to Murfield to establish this community. And they had a couple of ideas about what it would be like. One of the ideas they had would be that, like all monastic communities, would be centered on common work. So all of the brethren would participate in growing the food and building the buildings and tending the gardens and doing the evangelistic work of monastics. And they decided that they would start a theological college, which is English taught for a seminary. And distinctly, they wanted to start a theological college that would be for men, because at this time only men were admitted, who could not afford to pay for theological college, which meant that in the Anglican Church of the 19th century, only the wealthy could be ordained. And so they began to attract working class men to be trained for ordination. There is a sense still to this day of that kind of popular understanding of education in what's called the College of the Resurrection. The college is right there on the campus or the close of the monastery. And if you're here last fall, you may remember Lois Ward, who was interning here some. She was also a student at CDSP. And Lois was finishing her last year. In fact, I got to the Community of the Resurrection, to the Resurrection House, which is their retreat guest house. And I got upstairs to my third floor bedroom, also known as the second floor. Because the woman was like showing me, she's like, well, I'm afraid you're on the second floor. I'm like, oh, that's not too bad. And I got to the second floor, she's like, oh, no, it's on the second floor. I was like, ground floor, first floor, second floor. And I'm like lying on my bed and knock, knock, knock on the door, and it's Lois. And she walks in to say hi. We had a lovely visit. She said how much she enjoyed her time here and how she had taken so much of what she had learned here back to Murfield, to the college. She later invited me over for gin and tonics with the students. go to their Thursday night mass, which is a student kind of a deal, which is lovely. The whole thing was lovely. But I landed in the community of the resurrection in Murfield, sort of like having been more or less in the lap of luxury for 2 weeks. And I discovered that there is a different kind of pleasure, of course, in the rhythm of that monastic life. So we pray together four times a day. You got matins at 6:45 in the morning. You've got noonday prayer followed by mass at noon. You've got vespers or evensong at, I can't remember when, 6, 5:30, something like that. You got compline at 9:15. And I was there with my icon-making materials. They very generously gave me a separate bedroom that they turned into a studio, which had like crime scene plastic film on the floor. And I know that's what it was, because every time anybody would walk by, they would say, "It looks like a crime scene." But there's like a little sink in the corner and a table and a chair and all of my supplies. So I could do my work there and then go up to the second floor, third floor, to rest, reflect, read, and so on, and walk everywhere. 20 acres of monastic enclosure, including a stone quarry, which had been turned into an amphitheater. Because in the 1920s, when Anglo-Catholicism was quite a growing trend in the Church of England, they would have evangelistic missions where they would fill this amphitheater for preaching and sacramental life. Spectacular. But now it's sort of overgrown, and there are 13 brethren of the community, and probably 40 students, a few faculty that are not monastics. And I would sit in worship. I would sit in the daily office. I would sit in the Eucharist, in the chapel, which was built by members of the community, which is big, bigger than this building, counting both parts, made of stone and plaster, very simple, sort of Cistercian looking, with a gigantic crucifix which hangs over the altar, which in this plan is sort of in the middle of the room. And they have chairs set up like we do here. And beyond that, and this room has been reconfigured in the last decade. In the back of it, they have what they call the Chapel of the Resurrection, which is the place where the daily mass is offered. And dogs are not allowed. I am. Okay. So let me tell you what I noticed. Oh, by the way, why did I go to the Community of the Resurrection? Anybody? Was anyone in the room ever a student of the College of the Resurrection? Oh, Rick Fabian was. And Rick, when was that? 1968 to 1970. Right. And you may recall that Rick founded St. Gregory's Church. And I was very curious to see what the continuities between our practice and their practice are. And it was very enlightening to actually be in a place that was in so many ways very alien, very different. I mean, you know, you've heard of Anglo-Catholicism. It's a very high church, fancy way of being in church. Very sacramentally present. You can't pass in front of the Chapel of the Resurrection where the sacrament is reserved without genuflecting. There's a lot of dedication to Our Lady there. There's a lot of people in black cassocks, including the students who dress like the brethren. So it's very different, and at the same time, it's very similar. So I would go to any of the offices, any of the morning, noonday, evening, Compline services. And what I would notice is they do psalm chanting like we do psalm chanting. So if you were here earlier this morning at daybreak, we chanted a lot of psalms. And when we're on our game, we usually pause in the middle of the verse, right? And other times we chant the psalm, we try and do that too. They do it like a lot. I was talking to Lois about it. I was like, how do the students learn to do this? And she's like, oh, the first few weeks of term are awful. Because nobody can figure out how to do it. And I was like, well, so that what happens? And she said, what I have said before about chant here, well, we just get used to listening to each other. Most of their singing is unaccompanied. They do have a rather fabulous organ, which is used to play a hymn. But the whole sense of settling into that deep listening to each other through song is completely present in the practice of the community in the College of the Resurrection. I noticed while we were, you know, and they chant like different tones that are kind of printed out in the book. And I noticed some of those are very familiar because they're in our music book. I noticed that when it came to, so that's part of it, but I also noticed that when it came to the leadership in the liturgy, everybody takes a turn. Even the brothers who can't chant. So one day, two of the brothers who were really good in leading music were gone. And the other was, I think, gone too. Like the three top chanters were gone. And they were like trying to figure out how we're going to do this. Or the top four chanters. And they were just like, well, we're just going to do it. And they chanted some of it and they spoke some of it. But it's like everybody takes a part in leadership, including the students. So some of the students share in the leadership of the chant in the chorus of the liturgy. I mean, they just do. It's just what they do. What's remarkable to me about that is it's what we do. So everybody pitches in making church happen, right? In the choir, everyone follows Sanford's lead, but everybody is expected to pick up their part and to sustain the whole. For the liturgical leaders, you know, I'm sort of like on my good days. Now, everything is I'm talking about is on my good days. Because on my bad days, I'm a real bastard. It's one of the things I learned on sabbatical. Some of you may have noticed it before. But on my good days, I just trust that the lay leaders in the liturgy are doing what they need to do to move the whole thing forward. And I don't have to worry about it. And whatever happens is what happens. In any given liturgy, what happens is what needs to happen. And I saw that in the liturgy at the Community of the Resurrection. This sharing work thing extends. And I saw this in this kind of wonderful way because I had breakfast and dinner. So the monks all eat together in the refectory with the guests. And so when you eat together, and breakfast is in silence, and lunch is generally not in silence, except on penitential days when it's in silence. And then dinner is in silence except somebody reads. So somebody is reading from a book about John of the Cross, which was quite beautiful. And so that's the brethren, the brothers, and the guests. And then in the college, there's another refectory for the students. And the students do the same thing. Breakfast is in silence. Lunch, you can talk. And dinner, I was actually there for a fancy schmancy day, so I think, I don't know what happens at dinner. But all the students take a turn serving the food and doing the dishes. So, you know what a scapular is? It's like a big apron-y thing. Front and back. So the students wear a gray scapular. The brethren wear a black scapular. But when the students are serving in the refectory, they wear a white scapular. So you can actually tell who's doing the work. So we signify what we do here in the way that we dress. says, and people ask this who are visiting, is Sanford a priest because he's dressed up like one? No, I mean, it's like, I'm not a Scotsman, even though I'm wearing a fabulous kilt. I'm doing this to signify tea party. So the idea that our service and our work extends both to what we do in worship and also what we do in everydayness is a very live part of the community of the resurrection. So there are other things that I noted, and I'll share those as they occur to me. Those are some of the highlights of what I noticed just being embedded in this monastic community. Now, I will say that the number of the brothers of the community has dwindled over the years. So the brothers don't do all the work themselves. They do some of it, but they don't do it all. And they actually have hired some folks to come and help with tending the garden and so on and so on. But one of the brothers still takes care of the fruit trees. One of the brothers makes the delicious yogurt that I had at breakfast every morning, and so on and so on. And apparently there's this thing called Brexit happening. And I was talking with one of the brothers about Brexit, and he said, well, you know, all of the brethren are against Brexit, and all of the people that work here are for it, because it's an issue of economics and class. And in the north of England, which is traditionally more, traditionally, whatever that means, there is a more conservative political environment in the north of England now than in the south of England. And, you know, I had one woman in particular try to explain why Brexit was a great thing to me. Yeah, and I was like, okay, I hear what you're saying, but I'm also on retreat, so I'm not going to argue with you. Because I don't have to. So there was an interesting kind of background noise to what was happening in the monastery while I was there. Towards the end of my retreat, I was done. I didn't want to come back. I didn't want to leave. I'd had a really transformative time there, making art, which I'm going to actually talk about next week, and had really been deeply embedded in this experience of the cycle of prayer and the cycle of simplicity of that. Has anybody ever taken a monastic retreat before? Yeah, so you may have a sense of what that's like. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's Buddhist or Christian or what of, because it still has the same simplicity of rhythm to it, right? It's like I'm there for one thing. Like when I'm here, I have to talk to people and fix the toilet and write a sermon and I don't know what else. So my portfolio is full. When I'm there, I have three things to do, which lowers the blood pressure. So if anybody ever says you should go on a retreat, just go. But I did leave. I left Murfield. I got on a train. I figured out how to use British Rail. Yay! There's an app, which was very important because as I was going from Murfield to Liverpool, I discovered that one of the legs of my trip had been canceled. So I was able to rebook it on the train. Yay! I'm smart. And I got to Liverpool. Who's ever been to Liverpool? I love Liverpool. Liverpool's had an economic renaissance in the last decade plus. It was a European city of culture. And I was there as the guest of Paul Bays, the Bishop of Liverpool, who was with us here about a year and a half ago. Who knows Paul Bays? Okay, I can tell you anything. Paul Bays is a traditional English evangelical who had a conversion experience to loving gay people and justice. Well, he was always a justice person. So his world has opened up. And when he was here, I took him to dinner. I don't know who he was. I just knew he was a bishop, whatever. And it was great. So he invited me on June the 8th. Why is that date important? Carrie's ordination date. He invited me to participate in the ordinations at the cathedral in Liverpool. So I got to vest and like go up and lay hands on people. They had like 14 ordinations to the priesthood. And I discovered, because every person I saw who I said I was going to the Liverpool Cathedral said, you know, it's the largest enclosed space in Europe. And it was. It was ginormous. They had an art installation in. As you go in the front door, there's like this weird front part. And then there's like weird bridge thing before you get to the nave and steps and all this stuff. But as you walk in, the first thing they had was this internally lit globe of the earth, which was 23 feet in diameter, hanging about that high off the ground, and it was slowly spinning. It was like this incredible art installation. I mean, if it was here in the rotunda, it would fill more than the two dancing Saint Rose, and we wouldn't have much headroom. We'd have enough. I would have enough. And it was super weird because, you know, I hadn't seen Paul yet. Somebody picked me up. It was lovely people. They gave me some lunch. And, like, the bishop's assistant gives me a suitcase with vestments in it to put on. So I go downstairs and put my vestments on. And I'm, like, processing around following this guy. And I get in. And I see Paul before the liturgy starts. And he gives me a big hug. And it's like, you don't look like the Paul Bays I saw last time, because now you're wearing a golden mitre and a ginormous cope and everything else. And you're in the largest enclosed space in Europe, and there's a 23-foot globe behind you, and it was pretty spectacular. So the ordination thing happened. And it's such a big space, they had like screens, because the clergy are sitting over the side, you just like watch what's happening. And every time the bishop would lay hands on a person, we all lean in and lay hands on them too, right? So I was like reaching out, putting my hand on somebody's shoulder, like we do here. And then this thing happened, which I've actually written about. So the ordinations were done. I only cried once when I saw the newly ordained man holding his infant and snuggling with him. And then we had communion, which is like communion is. And then it came time for the post-communion hymn. And the bishop is wearing his gold stuff, right? And he's standing at the altar. And he just starts singing. I got my hand on the gospel plow. And he just starts singing gospel plow. I'm like, what the? Because, like, this is the largest enclosed space in Europe, and you're wearing gold. And he just, like, improvised this thing. And he, like, sang the whole thing, a couple of verses. And then he sang the doxology. And I asked him later, I was like, why did you do that? He's like, well, you know, it's a piece of Thomas Gray, and he read it, so I just decided to throw that in too. I'm like, who are you, Mr. Improvisational Liturgy Person? How did you get the freedom to do that? And he told me. I mean, it's just like he trusts in the Spirit of God and the Spirit of God in the lives of the people that are present to sustain the whole community in its life together. Which gave me a greater sense of what it means to be in leadership, right? It's about trusting your own power to improvise and trusting in the power of God present in the lives of each person to sustain whatever's happening. So the liturgy was over, and I went over to the bishop's house, and I found my chintz-lined room, took a little lie down, got up, had dinner, met one of the bishop's canons is from Virginia. Another bishop's canons is this woman named Ellen, who got her PhD in musical theater. So we were like talking about all sorts of things over dinner. Anyway, and then you like go to bed, and then before I went upstairs, the bishop's like, I'm not going to church in the morning. I'm like, it's Pentecost, don't you? He's like, I got a thing in the afternoon. He's like, we'll just say prayers in my study. I'm like, okay, that's cool. So we did. So we had prayers together in a study, and it was like church. So then he took me to the train station, and I made my penultimate stop in England. in Litchfield. Who's ever been to Litchfield? I can tell story. There's a hand rising up back there. Litchfield's a great town. Litchfield, what? Okay. Litchfield is an old English cathedral town with an ancient cathedral in it. And another person who's been to St. Gregory's, Pauline Shelton. Pauline was a great friend of Megory Anderson's. And in fact, some of Megory's ashes I took to Pauline so that she could bury them at Canterbury. So the first of my three high teas that week was with Pauline. And then, you know, I went to her. She's a diocesan staff person, right? She works for the bishop in Litchfield. And she invited me to come to her team meeting. She's in charge of ordinands and formation. And then she, as I'm sitting there eating the Englishy sandwiches, she's like, why don't you tell everybody what you're working on? So I did, which is weird. And I discovered that in Litchfield, people are really curious about St. Gregory's. I know, right? It's weird. How did this happen? What is this world I live in? And we had this wonderful exchange. I'm fast-forwarding because I don't want to hold you all. I want to let you ask some questions. And then I got from Litchfield to London, and Grant met me in London. But before Grant, the pescatarian husband of mine, met me in London, I went to this restaurant called St. John. I got your attention there, Anna Marie. Where for dinner that night I had brains two ways. A lamb's brain. Little lamb, who made thee? So delicious. So lamb brains on toast, plus a pork scratching salad, plus just a little bit of sweetbreads. Delish. Sorry to scandalize.
What's the chef's name who runs it?
What's the chef's name that runs it?
Ferguson.
Thank you. Oh, you went there too. We were talking about this, yeah. So there it was. What? So there it was. And Grant Martin shows up, and we have a great week together in London town. And then I flew back here. And I've basically been based in San Francisco since the 19th of June. Had several side trips. Had to cancel one of them. Saw my family twice. Went to my aunt's 90th birthday. Went to Chicago for my father-in-law's knee replacement surgery and spent the whole day at the Art Institute of Chicago while he was having surgery. And found out a lot of stuff. Discovered a lot of things that I'm going to be talking about for the next X number of weeks. Mostly want to sort of wrap this part up by saying how grateful I am to have been given the privilege of time away from the parish. How grateful I am to Carrie, who, God willing, is still in the room someplace. For caring for you all in my absence. So when Carrie told me about the farm, can I tell the story, Carrie?
Yeah, you can tell
the story. It was right after Megory Anderson's cremation. So we're like driving out to Marin, and I'm talking to Carrie about her next job opportunity. She's like, I need to tell you something. I was like, okay. She's like, let's wait till after the service. And I was like, okay. I thought, I'm in really big trouble. I did something really bad. And she told me. And I did not try to talk her out of it. And I said something to the effect of, I have complete confidence in the ability of St. Gregory's community to make more out of this. I didn't say it exactly. I said a lot of words. Because I do. In the same way that I had complete confidence in Carrie's ability to guide and lead this congregation in my absence, I have great confidence in this community as we grow forward in our next invention. which we've been doing apparently for 40-plus years. The weird thing about Carrie's leaving is that it could not have come at a better time in relation to my perception of the congregation. Because I feel in many ways even more curious about the future of St. Gregory's, and more curious about how we will grow into the next iteration of who the church is. Because another thing I need to talk to you about in my sabbatical reflections is what else I found out about the Episcopal Church while I was away. And I think how we are both affected by that and also can help to lead the movement that is happening. Just to give you a foretaste of Glory Divine, the Episcopal Church is collapsing as a denomination. Everybody knows it. I'll just say it out loud. We're like, it's like we have an open femoral artery wound in the Episcopal Church. People are not coming to church anymore. Membership is dropping. Dollars are going up because we're rich. Always have been. And we're all having to figure out what it means to be church in this new era. Now, St. Gregory's is a healthy, growing, vibrant congregation for which I am very, very grateful. And I hope you are as well. Which is why it's important for us to recognize our ability and our giftedness at this time in the history of the Episcopal Church to continue doing what we've been doing, which is to move forward the conversation about who we are and who we long to be. So, that's my reflection thus far. In the next few weeks, we'll be doing a couple of interesting things. I have not talked to the whole vestry about it, but I've talked to the two conveners about it. I think it's time for us to do a strategic plan to figure out what exactly we want to do in the next 5 years and see what it looks like moving forward so that we don't just keep doing the same old thing again. So, yeah, I filled all the time with my words, but I wonder if anybody has any very fast questions or clarifications. Yeah, Tonya.
Welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back. Joseph.
Just to give a little bit of context, most mainline churches are imploding and hemorrhaging.
Yeah. Oh, all churches are. No. All churches are, even mega churches. Yeah. Every Christian denomination and movement in America is cratering. Yeah, as it turns out. A little bit? We did a bad job of evangelism, and we stopped believing in the saving power of Jesus Christ. Besides that, everything's great. John?
How would you say your sabbatical has changed?
I've lost 10 pounds, and my blood pressure is down to like, which is the high number, the first one or the second? That's a high one?
Yeah.
Like 120 over 72. I ain't gonna last unless I start spending serious time away from you all. No. I'm gonna do my best to stay as healthy as I can be. Because I note that I'm happier when I'm healthier. I got great knees, if you like that kind of fat knee thing. Breton. That's going to be next week. You got to come back. Yeah, next week I'm going to talk about a couple of really amazing things that I discovered. I'll just give you a foretaste. Where are my iconographers? Betsy. Where's Judith? Judith. Guess who made their own icon boards? I did. Yeah. I made my own icon boards. I didn't cut. Don't be ugly. So yeah, we can have an icon board making workshop. and then we'll never do it again. No, I cheated. I'll talk to you later about that. I did the gesture. I didn't want to invest in power tools. Right. Nice. Okay, it has become 10:30, which apparently is the time to stop. Sanford, what's the choir singing today?
We're singing Hallelujah by Yay!
That's that little quiet, subtle piece.